You are listening to episode 176 of the Frilla Bros Tech Podcast, The Life and Death of Radio Shack.
Episode 176 of the Furlough Bros Tech Podcast. Today is February the 8th, 2015. I'm Matthew Dean Furlough, and with a live musical performance, it's my brother, James Furlough.
Yeah, I'm not going to sing at all, just so you know.
You're going to be going for the spoken word Grammy?
Yes. This is a song. It is not too long. Too long. Now it is all gone.
Yeah.
Thank you. Hold your applause.
It's the big joke of all the EGOT winners because they're like, you know, it's three of them are acting arts, stage, TV, and movies, but the Grammys is the tough one, so they all do this spoken word. It just feels like it's cheating. If you don't get one for like best album, best song, something like that. Why even try to brag? You're not an EGOT. You're an EGOT loser. You're no better than me.
I don't know about that, but
I'm super critical about my artists. You know what I really love? When people that like support and follow our podcast all the time start texting us right at me, right as the podcast starts. It's like, if anybody should know that I'm busy right now, it's you. So I'm going to turn off all my notifications.
I had that problem. It's weird. I must not have any. So that's cool. My friends respect me. Let's put it that way. How about that?
Oh, yeah. That's right.
We'll go that route.
It's more mature.
Yeah.
So did you see Jupiter Ascending this week?
Oh, yeah. No, what is that?
What is that? It's the new
Wachowski movie.
The creators of the Matrix.
Oh. No, I
didn't even... You didn't even know it was coming out?
Is it good?
It's all right. It's Channing Tatum.
That doesn't help me.
Mila Kunis. It's like a science fiction epic. The action's pretty freaking cool. But then again, you know, it's the guys that made The Matrix. It's sort of the bellhorn of what they're good at. Plot's a little bit weak, you know, frankly. They borrowed heavily from the dramatic elements of The Matrix. I feel like if you're not my age and were like super into The Matrix, if you were 10 years younger than me and maybe saw The Matrix once on TV, you'd be really impressed by it because it's, you know, it's new to you. But
old hat to you, huh? You're like, yeah, I've seen this.
This makes me want to go watch The Matrix again.
That's fair. No, I didn't even hear about it. That's how in it I am.
Yeah.
Oh, that's pathetic. I don't even have a kid yet, and I'm.
It's not like you're busy stuff. With other things. That's okay. That's what I'm here for, James. To keep you.
I appreciate it. Yeah, if you do watch a good movie, let me know. Just put it out there.
Gotcha. Yeah, no, I will.
Or if you know of one coming up, let me know of that too.
Ant-Man, Avengers 2.
Are you excited about Ant-Man? That doesn't, yes. Like, okay.
I like Paul Rudd. I think I've...
Yeah, I do like him too.
I'm a remarkably big Paul Rudd fan. Like, I think this is the first time I've ever actually saying this out loud. But I'm not sure I've seen a Paul Rudd movie that I did not enjoy a lot. And really? It's sort of like you with what's her name and what's his name?
Amy Adams.
There we go, Amy Adams. You know, it's like, it's an Amy Adams movie. How could I be disappointed? We've got the same taste in movies.
Who's the other guy?
Matthew McConaughey?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Pretty much everything they're in. I love it. So yeah. You, Paul Rudd, huh?
Paul Rudd, yeah. He's kind of my boy.
That's fair.
So I'm you know, one of the cool parts about Ant-Man is like his whole deal is he's like the smartest of the Avengers. Like he's the Avenger that makes all the other Avengers look normal.
Okay.
Which you know, is a statement when you consider, like, that, especially that very well done scene in the first Avengers, where they're all talking about nuclear physics and stuff, and they're all like crazy smart. I don't know how they're gonna do it in the movie. It looks like they might have changed around the characters, but yeah, generally speaking, Ant-Man is like, he's the smart guy of the team, which is an impressive position to hold amongst the likes of Bruce Banner and Tony Stark. And Peter Parker, and the list of geniuses keeps going on and on.
I guess that's true. That's interesting. I hopefully I can get behind it. I like, apparently Guardians of the Galaxy is amazing and everyone loves it. I am struggling to get behind it.
That's right. You didn't like that movie.
I know, which is like, I feel like I've missed something. And I should probably just watch it again and I'll love it. Because I know the first time I watched Napoleon Dynamite, I was like, this is the dumbest movie ever.
Yeah.
And then I watched it the second time and went, this movie's awesome.
My classic example of that is Zoolander, where the first time I watched it, I was like, that's stupid. And then like 2 weeks later, I found myself quoting it all the time, just incessantly. It's like, I should probably watch this movie again. I think it was better than I realized.
Funny. Yeah, that's probably true of Guardians. And so I guess all that to say, I'm fearful that it's like, for Ant-Man, I'll be like, oh, whatever. But
yeah. I love this time of year, because I love the coming soon movie season. And this one's a good one, because we've also got, what's it called? Obviously, the new Star Wars movie comes out this year. But so does the new Jurassic Park movie. And I'm trying to think of, this is a big movie season this year. This one's going to be pretty good.
I've kind of decided that I want to watch Jurassic World in IMAX 3D. I don't really have a good reason for it, other than I feel like it would be a good one to go watch it in.
Yeah, I got a feeling I'm picking up what you're laying down, as it were. I agree. Very excited about that movie.
Which is actually an investment for me, because I have to go like to Portland.
Oh yeah, that's right. You got to drive a long ways. I've got like 8 in my area, but yeah, it's nice to live in the Bay.
Yeah, whatever.
The perks of this area. But you know what, James? We're not here this week to talk about coming movies. Unfortunately, sometimes I wish that's what we were here to talk about, but it's not what we're talking about this week. There's actually been some exciting tech news this week. So this week, like every week, we'll be talking about technology in the continuing corporate opera. And by that, I mean the soap opera of corporations, dealings back and forth, the people working for them, their marketing campaigns, the technology they're developing, the companies that are collapsing under their own stagnant weight, and all that sort of stuff. But before we get into the heart of the show, speaking of companies collapsing under their own stagnant weight, James has got a short disclosure he's going to throw us at us.
So HP has an internal collaboration tool. We'll call it an internal social network.
Yeah.
It's called OneHP is the name of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was Meg's whole mantra, right? We are OneHP. We're not separating. Well, now that we are, this should not come as a shock, but they're discontinuing that social network.
Oh, my gosh.
Like, we're not anymore. So now we're flipping over to Yammer, apparently it is. Is apparently what we're switching over to. So Microsoft, you win in the end, which I guess makes sense because we use Microsoft Outlook, Office, Link, which is their communication thing. So it makes sense to adopt Yammer, and who knows, maybe one day we'll be doing Skype to Skype stuff. But all that to say, I work for HP. However, I do not represent HP, their choices of internal communication tools, or any other opinion that they may have.
That's probably a good thing. I've got a short disclosure to throw out there.
Yeah.
Facebook is messing me up, those jerks. I made some good, healthy, bank, investing in Apple Inc., for a week or two. And, Facebook has managed to decimate all of my earnings. Thanks, guys. I appreciate it. I am currently sitting...
Wow, they suck more than just your negative... time, huh? Nice.
Yep. I am currently sitting at negative $2 from my initial starting point, which is actually negative $30 from my highest point. Brought to you by Apple Inc. So I'm a little bit disappointed. I'm currently a Facebook owner, and maybe probably not for this week. If I can get me back up to like 505, you know, like back above, so I don't feel like I complete. Even though I'll be down from where I started, just from when I bought Facebook, yeah. But up from my like initial investment, I'll feel better, and then we'll move on to somebody else. On to the next one.
Oh man, that's what happens when you gamble, bud.
It's not, yeah.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. It is. It's purely gambling. And I'm doing it, it's funny, I'm doing it just for the sake of, like, being interested and invested, but...
It's tough when you're... It's more fun when you're gaining money than losing it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I get it.
Especially because that's 500 bones I could spend on fun things. But that's all right. So, if you want to follow us throughout the week, we have a couple of social network stuff that we do. I am at Twitter, at Matthew D. Furlow, but, you know, it's Twitter, so I don't really do anything. But my Instagram, that's what I'm all about. Check out my Insta, nextwiggin4 is my user tag.
Are you that into Instagram?
Are you about to call me out on the air for not actually being in? Yeah, I check Instagram every day.
Next Wiggin, or you check it?
Yeah, I was going to say. And I oftentimes like
pictures.
Let's
see, the last picture you took was 1 week ago. The one before that was 3 weeks ago.
Okay.
Now, 3 weeks ago, you've got like three pictures.
How about you mind your own business, okay?
All right, I'm just okay. I'll do that.
We're trying to get people to follow us throughout the week.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Well, give them a reason to follow.
What are you doing to the show? Yeah, that's a good point.
I think I outposted it, to be honest. Which, if you're interested in that, you could check out my posts on Twitter, at James Furlow, because they show up there, in addition to Instagram. Or my Tumblr blog, which is jamesfurlow.com. So I repeat everything over and over. It's kind of how that works.
Yeah. It's how you manage your, maximize your potential. It's true. We talk about all sorts of stuff on this show. A lot to keep track of. We understand if you're not taking notes. We're a little bit disappointed, but, you know, it's okay. We're going to help you out here. Go to our website, furlowbros.com. Everything you could possibly need is right there for you. All the articles we talk about, we're going to show, put the links up there. So if there's videos or whatever, and you just want more information, check it out. Also, the link to the podcast and the link to the YouTube video. Immerse yourself in what we have to offer, and it'll be good.
It will be good. I want to start out with a quirky, fun story.
Okay.
There is a guy out there who he edits Wikipedia.
Okay.
He is one of the top 10 editors of Wikipedia.
That's impressive.
Yes, it is. He's made... a little bit north of 46,000 edits. 47,000 edits. And he's been doing this since 2007.
Now, when you're actually at that position, I've never been super clear on the actual structure of Wikipedia. Obviously, anybody can edit it in theory. Yeah. But once you get to a certain level of an editor, it's kind of like a full-time job, isn't it? Like,
no, it's all volunteer work.
Well, but I mean, but you are...
Okay, so to be clear, this guy holds a regular full-time job. He's not married, which you'll understand in a little bit. His name is Brian Henderson. He's a software engineer. He's 51 years old.
Given everything you've described so far, I have a feeling I'm going to label this guy as an odd duck really quickly.
Probably. So anyways, this guy, he's made quite a number of edits since 2007. And almost all of them address one singular linguistic pet peeve.
Yeah, he's going to be labeled as an odd duck.
Every Sunday night before going to bed, Mr. Henderson follows an editing routine that allows him to efficiently work on approximately 70 to 80 new comprised of, that particular phrase right there, comprised of airs that appear on the encyclopedia each week. The entire process takes about an hour at most.
Okay. What? Well, I don't understand the air.
Okay, yep. Let me help you out here. So you might have a phrase that says, the Wikipedia editorial community is comprised of many interesting people.
Right.
All right. So the problem is rooted in confusion over the verbs to comprise and to compose. So most style manuals advise against this usage, and better alternatives to the above example include the following. The Wikipedia editorial community is composed of many interesting people. Or, the Wikipedia editorial community consists of many interesting people.
Okay.
Mr. Henderson, he wrote a 6,000-word essay that explains why it is ungrammatically correct.
I have officially decided he's an odd duck. A 6,000-page essay. I've written a lot. That is an unbelievable amount. Like, how do you even do that? A 6,000-page essay is... I gotta give this context, because this is just, that's actually hard to really wrap your head around. A 6,000-page essay times, let's give him the benefit of the doubt. He double spaced each page, so it's gonna be 250 words per page, which is 1.5 million words, divided by the average length of a novel, which is 100,000 words. That's like 15 novels. That's
wait,
easily.
No. Are you thinking this
a
right?
6,000 page
wait,
essay?
Wait, what did I say?
A 6,000 page
essay.
No,
6,000 word essay.
Okay, that is significantly shorter.
Yes.
That's a 24 page essay.
Okay, good. I was like, wait, why are you freaking out over this? I mean, it's a lot on a single phrase, but...
Yeah, because an essay that was twice the long length of Harry Potter is significantly different than a essay I can breeze through in about 30 minutes.
Okay. Avoided that one. I must have said page. No, word. 6,000 word essay. Which is still big, which is still a lot. So it turns out that not everyone likes his mission.
I believe it.
Yeah. So I guess when he first started out, you can label something as a minor edit or like a regular edit, and he used to just call them minor edits because he's like, whatever, I'm fixing this phrase, no big deal. And he goes, and people used to get upset at him. Because apparently, you know, you write a page, you start to take ownership over it, and you feel responsible for it.
Right.
And so he'd go in and, you know, change it, and they'd be like, what the heck? No, that's wrong. And try to change it back. Pretty crazy. And so now he's like, okay, I won't call it a minor edit for those people who think it's a big deal. But apparently a ton of editors have, like, they've learned of their grammatical issue from his edit and have repented of their ways.
That's funny.
But yeah, pretty crazy that
okay.
So apparently, like, the way that this guy, the writer of this article, his editor switched a verb of comprised of to composed, but he was like, he didn't understand why. And so he started researching why he changed it, and that's where he came across the essay and then figured out what he was doing and ultimately wrote this. But yeah, pretty crazy guy.
Well, what I think is interesting, and this kind of goes back to what I started with, like, how Wikipedia editing works is kind of weird. Have you ever edited a Wikipedia article before?
No, I haven't.
So it's kind of a weird system, because what they do is they have their trusted editors, and basically what happens is if you edit something, it gets flagged. Like, if you, the first time you log in and edit something, it gets flagged. And it gets flagged to one of their, for lack of a better term, one of their power editors. And somebody who has a tremendous amount of editors who's kind of like a trusted editor. And then they can go through. And that those guys, like you said, they're not employees of Wikipedia, but they're a special class of member. And it's like when they lock down articles because they're getting too edited and it's they're controversial articles, quote unquote, it's that group of editors that actually go through and manage that process. So as a guy that's one of your top 10 editors, I'm sure he's one of those who can do that. And I think what you're finding is that the consequence of that, of him labeling it as a major edit, is probably it locks the edit. They can't go back and revert it
anymore. No, he was saying they could. Maybe he's not a top 10 even editor. I don't know.
It's weird, and they're actually not super. I mean, I've looked into it a little bit. Maybe I'm just an idiot and couldn't figure it out. But from kind of where I was looking at it, it seemed a little bit obfuscated what exactly the structure of editing was. And I've always been, you know, especially when they get into those, like, you know, the articles every once in a while you read where there's some controversy in the Wikipedia editing community, and they're doing stuff that's not that has conflicts of interest and things like that. Part of that comes from the fact of just how the structure works is these guys can't be fired because they don't work for the organization. Right. They're just everybody's supposed to be equal in the open sourced Wikipedia, the crowdsourced Wikipedia. And yet there are editors who clearly get better treatment, and some of them have sold their services once they get to that point. So, somehow I got a feeling that you won't be able to get this guy to sell out for his his mission.
Yeah, well, apparently he went through all of Wikipedia and changed them all, and now is going back and taking on new ones. But here's the crazy part. The number one guy, the most prolific editor, is 32 years old. He lives in Indianapolis. His name is Justin Knapp. Care to guess how many edits he's made so far?
Oh, I don't know, a million.
1.45 million.
That is a lot of edits.
Yeah.
I'm gonna take a wild stab here. Not married either.
probably not. The crazy part is that his is sometimes assisted by semi-automated software. That he's running.
He's got Boston for him.
So they said, like, there was one point within a few hours on January 30th of this year, he was able to make nearly 1,000 category tweaks to Pakistan-related articles. So he's also removed unsourced and redundant information about songs on an upcoming Dylan album and created a new section on the article for Glenda Ritz. So, yeah, he does some... That's a lot of edits. Pretty crazy.
Yeah. That is crazy. The Wikipedia world is actually... It's a weird one.
Now, when he was asked what motivates him, Henderson says he views his pursuit as similar to that of people who choose to spend their Saturdays picking up litter from the side of the road. I really do think I'm doing a public service, but at the same time, I get something out of it myself. It's hard to imagine doing it for the rest of my life. I don't have any plans to quit, but I guess eventually I'll have to find a way. It's hard to walk away, especially when I've actually accomplished something.
Yeah, that's... That's interesting, man. You know what he is, James? He's an odd duck. That is a...
I like it.
I look at this as a public service, cleaning up the... You know, hey, if it makes you happy, I'm glad he's happy. I am glad he's happy. And that is, he's probably doing more good in the world than bad. I'm not sure how much with his particular hobby, but I'm sure it's, you know, I'm actually not surprised that it's programmers that are your top guys, because I'm sure it's got to be, you know, using bots that at least find the stuff and highly automate the process. You know, it seems like, because if you were to create a script that could read articles, crawl the pages for any use of it, then put those uses in front of him, and then he'd have a tool that had a couple of choices where it would say, you can pick and automatically edit it with with one of your like various options that you mentioned, or just stick with it, and then his tool would remember, okay, we've already looked at this one, and mm-hmm. so it's this one's done. But that is so funny. Man. So, taking a changing lanes a little bit here.
Nice.
Apple has been uncovered working on a secret project, and this is kind of exciting. It's one of those projects where they're definitely doing something, but nobody knows exactly what. Apple has bought minivans. And that's odd in and of itself, I suppose, because, right? Did you just accuse
what
them of being rapists?
No. Stealing children, yes, but selling rapists, no.
Okay, all right. Yes. You're right, you know what? You did not accuse them of being rapists. That was a leap too far for me. Apple... It's been confirmed that there's these Dodge Caravans that they've bought and owned. People are driving them around, and they got these like crazy camera things on top of them. It's got a bunch of it's this rig that mounts on top of the cars, and they're all wired up with cameras and stuff. They've been seen in different areas. They've been seen in Brooklyn. They've been seen in different places. But everybody's like getting excited. What could this possibly be? It's so cool. It's, Apple's got some new project. People are throwing out there that maybe something like, competitors with Google automated driving cars, because they're talking about how many cameras it has and the different sensors. And then they were talking about, different cool projects they could be working on. I just wanted to come out here and say, amongst all the rumors, that, it's none of those things, and everybody's being dumb. They are clearly just doing a street view for, Apple Maps, and this is their equivalent of the Google Street View cars. I don't even understand. I don't like these sorts of rumors. I just try to let them slide, because they, they bother me when it's clearly obvious what's going on, but people try to make it into a bigger thing. But this is just obviously not a bigger thing than that. They've got the whole bird's eye view thing, and it works pretty well. I think I like it, but Street View is a huge selling point for Google Maps, and they know it. And as they try to continue to build out a more compelling Maps offer, this is something that they need to have. And so they've got these cars. And the funniest part about this is most people acknowledge the fact that Apple doesn't have a license for it. Everybody's really hoping that they're competing with Google for the self-driving cars. And that's kind of been the biggest, most exciting of the possible rumors. But every state they license that stuff. Like, you can't just have self-driving cars on the roads. That's not legal. And every company that's engaged in that has special licenses through the various DMVs of the different states. and Apple doesn't. That's all public record. Like, obviously there's somebody behind the wheel. Not to mention the fact that Google self-driving these cars operate, they leverage all that cool camera technology, but one of the biggest things that they leverage is a really just incredibly thorough version of Apple or of Google Maps. It's this incredibly detailed, like potholes, all sorts of stuff that is just, that's not present except as a picture in, you know, human, normal people, Google Maps. They do tons of data logging, and that requires these super epic cars to go around and do street view. And the expectation at this point is that any automated, purely automated driving cars will be doing that on their own anyways. Or like anybody, any competitors will have to do that on their own unless they're using Google Maps. Like, so it just annoys me, man. It just annoys me when, how do these giant, everybody reads their article blogs and they're just so clearly not even thinking for a couple of minutes about what the implications are.
Nah, it's not for Street View.
Nah. You don't think so? What do you think it's for? Are you just doing that to rile me up? I'm assuming it's because somebody who's designing those rigs, you know, they probably either they bought a company or they they've contracted with the company and that was just what they were doing. It's a relatively cheap car, pretty good gas mileage, they're safe, and so they're, you know, whoever it was, you know, whoever built them decided, hey, we can do this, and Apple was happy about that. They're just going through somebody else. They're not doing what Google does, which is basically build the cars themselves and do huge branding so everybody can see them. You know,
I think it's pretty funny that they went after Rob, Enderle for their comments on this article. That guy has no idea what he's talking about ever. It's just like, so like, yeah. I mean, as an example here, it says Enderle said that this van simply has too many cameras, a whopping 12 of them, to be a mapping car. Though he failed to note that Google uses even more cameras on their own street view cars. Like, come on.
Yeah.
This guy's always, Mac Daily News is always making fun of him. It's like, no, he has no idea what he's talking about. All right, I'm with you, Street View.
Yeah, which is exciting. That's cool. I mean, you know, if you're an Apple Maps fan, you know, it's good for it. Yeah, they got to do it, and they got enough money to do it. You know, have a competitive product, okay?
Maybe so they're testing new iPhones. Maybe iPads on the go.
What? iCargos.
Boy, I just don't have a good enough imagination to hypothesize on what it could be besides the obvious, which Apple, I think this is the obvious.
Yeah, it's don't let your imagination run wild. It'll get you in trouble. The old Occam's razor.
Yeah, they always just do what's most straightforward. It's Google's the unknown.
Yeah, which is annoying. Actually, I prefer what Apple does.
Very hard to predict.
More trustworthy.
All right.
It's cool.
It is cool.
So, you didn't do a big article.
We'll survive.
Okay. Well, then, so this week, as is tradition on this show, we like to mark the deaths of companies. For whatever reason, there's something exciting and just fun about a company collapsing. And I hope it's never one of mine, although it probably will be, because I don't want to be on the other end of this the shotgun. But the Radio Shack did not have a good week. As far as your weeks can go, this is not one of their top ones.
That's true.
On Monday, rumors of a bunch of stores being bought by a bunch of the Radio Shack stores being bought by Sprint had come out. They suspended trading. Amazon started to get rumored that they would might buy some of the stores. And then by Thursday, they had filed for bankruptcy. And I don't know. Are there any Radio Shacks near you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Have you gone by any of them in the last week?
Last week?
Yeah.
Not the last week.
It was a light switch. It went from the stores were there, maybe big signs saying clearance sales, that sort of thing, to
really?
Empty. Every single one around me. Yeah, every single one.
Check that out. Now, I went, yes. I've been in the last month, and I bought something.
Yeah, I wish I had better timing, because I definitely would have gone and bought a bunch of Arduino stuff that I don't need, but was on Super Fire sale, because I just thought I'd have more time.
There's a lesson in there.
Yeah, right?
Don't know what, but there's one in there. I can sense it. Yeah, okay. No. Yeah, there's one in where I live and in the adjacent city, and I haven't been near either one of them, I guess, to check them out. But yeah, apparently they're no more.
Yeah. Yeah, well,
I was really hoping you were going to say like, now there's a ton of people in there reminiscing and buying stuff, but
nope.
Total opposite.
The stores are, yeah, they've like stripped everything off the walls. I mean, it is done. I do think it's very interesting though what's going on with like this whole thing. I mean, it's worth talking about, like what causes companies to fail long term, what's going to happen now? Because one of the things that everybody's always said is that Radio Shack, because they've been around for so long, they've actually got a ton of really good retail locations, like everywhere. It's amazing that they were able to squander such a good position when, you know, what are the top three most important things for a company? Location, location, location. And that's like the only thing they had, and they couldn't turn it into a profit margin. And so what a lot of, you know, so it's like we were, like I mentioned, Amazon rumored might be buying some of their locales. Sprint is getting pretty froggy about wanting to buy some of their locations, which actually makes a lot of sense. Because if you think about the big four carriers, right, you got AT&T, Verizon, Sprint, and T-Mo. And Sprint's really the only one that doesn't have a huge presence in what are those called, like stores.
So I was reading this article by Bloomberg Businessweek, and it's titled "Inside Radio Shack Slow Motion Collapse." Very fascinating. Nice long profile of them, but you know, it kind of talks well about their history and how they got to where they were today. And what's interesting about it is kind of like, for anyone who went into the store in the last couple of years, you knew that they were Dunskies. It was just a matter of time for that. And there were just a few things that they did that really, really messed them up, unfortunately. So, like, for example, when it first got started, it was this guy who had this idea of selling, like, computer accessory type stuff. And what was interesting about it was it was like two brothers or friends or something like that. It was two guys. And they started them up. And what was amazing is in Boston, apparently, London-born brothers. There we go, brothers. Theodore and Milton. In 1921, by the way,
wow,
they got it up to 9 stores. They were bringing in a significant amount of money, but were in the midst of going bankrupt. And their target audience were ham radio enthusiasts, by the way, which is how they came up with.
I couldn't tell by their name.
Yep. So what happened was, a banker, their main creditor, started to freak out because they owed like $7 million in debt. And
which is a lot in the 1930s.
Yeah, it's a lot today.
I mean, that's a lot today, but it's even more back then.
So those guys went to Charles Tandy, who he ran a chain of leather shoe stores. Or just leather stores, sorry. Not just shoes, just leather crafts. And this guy was doing pretty well and was also looking for a way to diversify his income. And so he ended up buying the company for $300,000. And they were worth something. Their annual sales were like $14 million, so he made a good steal of a deal there. And And so his strategy was to appeal to hobbyists. And so each store was small and staffed with people who knew about electronics. And they were stocked with electronic, you know, accessories, if you will, that had pretty good margins. The other thing he did was they ignored the big brand names and went for their own manufacturing setup and went for private brands and stuff like that.
Right.
So they, so they got into, like I said, accessories and batteries and transistors and capacitors and, you know, things like that. For a while, apparently, they even had a battery club where you could sign up and you were entitled to one free battery each month. And so you'd come in and get your free battery and hopefully spend some more money. Yeah, so kind of crazy. And so they did that. And people, you know, they were doing very, very well. And then in the 1970s, you know, that's when they were just like top of their game, if you will. You know what I mean? And right. And they talked about how they had like kids coming in there, like for example, a kid named Steve Jobs and another kid named Steve Wozniak would regularly go into Radio Shack to build their little blue box devices to trick out their phone systems. Right. And you know, and so they were just like they were doing really, really well. And then the computer revolution happened. And
I think this is a good place to stick this in, but I read a really interesting article this week called, it was titled, The Store That Built Silicon Valley. And it was basically a memoir of Radio Shack in the '80s and, you know, and that how it Silicon Valley could not have happened without Radio Shack or Radio Shack.
They made the TRS-80 and it was $600. Yes. And like you said, it ended up selling very, very well. It actually outsold Apple and their machines. Yeah, pretty...
Yeah, hey, if you can do it for a little bit, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, so I do think, like you said, they get a lot of credence. And they already had thousands of stores by then. And, you know, it wasn't anything crazy. And the big problem that they ran into, though, was that by the early 90s, they were no longer keeping up. You know, investing in computers and making better and better ones wasn't their forte. And so now instead of being one of the best on the market, it was just laughable. And so by 1993, they stopped making PCs. Now here's where the problem was. PCs were crazy margins. And it was also a very large part of their business. And so they've kind of got into the track of, you know, the big hits type thing. Because before then, it had all been about accessories and, you know, selling a bunch of little things. And then they had, you know, the big thing. And they got addicted to it. So then they went out looking for a new one. And in it, they found the almighty cell phone. Yeah, that's right. I like this. There was a Leonard, I can say it. Leonard Roberts. He was the former chief executive of Shawnee's and Arby's, by the way. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
He had a choice. He could either go work for Blockbuster Video or he could go work for Radio Shack. He went for Radio Shack, which,
you know, it survived a little bit longer.
Yeah, he didn't stay around that long. They were saying, I don't remember the exact stats of it, but it was like for the first 60 years at Radio Shack, they had like three CEOs. And then in the last 3 years of Radio Shack, it had six CEOs. You're just like, ooh, not good.
Yeah.
So what happened was they were on their way to switching over to the cell phone industry and, you know, or to selling cell phones. And when and I think this is what gets into what you were talking about, which is critically important here. When they first started, cell phones were a relatively new thing, you know, and Verizon and AT&T and Sprint and T-Mobile, they didn't have stores. And so Radio Shack became the place to go buy your cell phone. And so they actually did really well with the cell phones, and they became very popular again. And they figured it out where they were able to negotiate a deal where not only did they get a commission for selling you a phone, but they got part of your monthly subscription commission as well. Yeah.
Whoa, that's a deal.
It was a very good deal. And again, like you were talking about, you know, cell phones suddenly like became a thing, and they had the footprint already and the traffic. And right. So, you know, they again shot to the tops of the charts. Well, as you would imagine, that always happens, is those negotiations or those agreements expired, and the cell phone companies renegotiated gave them a whole lot less this time around. Plus, they started coming out with their own stores, and so people would not go into, you know, would go into those stores themselves. And then what was also interesting, and they say this is just one of those subtle things that you don't really think about, was in order to sign someone up on a phone contract, it took about 45 minutes. And we're talking about Radio Shacks that had one to two people in there. So if you were working on a phone contract, which was like you were mandated to, you know, sell these things, you would ignore the other customers who were coming in looking for accessories and parts. And so those hobbyists would get frustrated because they'd be like, whatever, you know, I'm not that into it. And so the hobbyists started to get upset, and it just, they said it just completely destroyed, what was the other thing? So the hobbyists started to get upset. And then the other thing that happened was these cell phones got smart. And now all of a sudden, these gadgets that Radio Shack used to sell, like voice recorders, GPS devices, answering machines, camcorders,
the whole suite
suddenly
of
got replaced. This one guy, he's a writer for the Trending Buffalo. He sifted through a Radio Shack ad from 1991 and found that his iPhone had negated any need for 13 of the 15 products being sold. And the list price on those items was $3,000.
Jeez.
And so it was just one of those where it was like, little did they know that, you know, the cell phone was unbelievably disruptive to them. It took way too much time. And I mean, this was kind of going to happen no matter what. But it negated the rest of their store, where they earned a healthy profit margins, as useless. And so they've started running into a problem, you know?
Yeah.
The crazy part, though, and they said, like, this is the big irony of it all, is that over the last few years, the do-it-yourself or maker trend has started back up again. But Radio Shack was so focused on the cell phones that they missed the trend that they had started way back in the day. And
you know, it's funny. You and I talked about it just like, well, last time I was probably about this time last year when they did their whole, you know, when they did the Super Bowl commercial where the 80s called, they want their store back, which has a special sense of irony today. As the 80s took it back finally. You know, it's one of those things where we talked about it, the idea that if we were to take over Radio Shack, what would we do today? And we said we'd focus back on the do-it-yourselfers. It's the maker community. That's a good community. There's a rich thing there that you can do, but you got to shift away from the cell phone stuff. And you know, and that, that's tough. It's
so it sounded like they attempted to do that, and so like they got into some 3D printing, they got into the personal drones, and they started selling those tiny, dirt cheap Raspberry Pi computers. But they said that the problem, it was just too late. You know, by then, like people like you and I had already been trained to go somewhere else. And though that like the somewhere else is some other online place and buy it there.
Yeah, that's the real killer. You know, I've been reading a lot because it's, you know, for, especially for do-it-yourselfers, people asking who goes to Radio Shack. And as somebody who has gone to Radio Shack a lot over the last couple of years, I've always done it because I needed some simple electrical component, resistor, transistor, diode, capacitor, something along those lines, something that was cheap and small, and I didn't want to wait for Amazon to ship it, and I just didn't want to drive all the way to Fry's. So I'd go to Radio Shack because I knew it was right there, and you know, and but it was always a disappointing, you know, it was wicked expensive. You'd buy one resistor and you could buy 20 online for the same price, or 7,000 from China for the same price, and probably 30 of those of 7,000 would actually work. but you know, when you look at what they did, what they were, I was a perfect excuse for why you would want to, what they could have done. It's funny that education component of it, that the educated staff is so important. And I think that's the part that's hard. Is, you know, what were their staff was educated on how to sell, you know, cell phones, right? That was what they were trying. That's what they were trying to do. And I've, you know, we've talked about one of my dreams, especially over the last decade has been, I've always thought it would be cool to do like a robotics, to do like a hobby shop, but something that focuses on robotics. But to me, the biggest part would be really wanting to have, really wanting to have educated staff members that can help teach, because that always drove me nuts. You'd go into hobby shops and the people behind the counter knew how to run the register. They didn't know anything about, you know, remote control planes or the, you know, this kind of electrical thing or that kind of component thing. And Radio Shack was the same way. I would walk in with I would purposefully grab headphones as I walked into a Radio Shack, so I wouldn't have their staff pestering me, because they wanted to sell me a cell phone. And if I asked them about some electrical component, they would do the, I don't know, let me read the box. I know more than you.
Yeah. Well, and it got even worse. That's where, the hard part. I mean, they were financially incentivized to sell you that stuff. Like, for example, whenever you sold a phone, they were required to offer insurance plans, and they had to keep asking until you said no 3 times. The other one said that the way it was set up was employees could keep the commissions on the phones only if they sold at least one accessory. Otherwise, manager took the sale. And, I mean, so it was just like, not only did they not know what was going on in the aisles and they did not know anything, but they were, like, financially incentivized to harass customers.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's one of those where, like, as you learn more about it, you go, well, no surprise, clearly lost their way. And I could see why they would go such high turnover of management and leadership, because they just go, this can't be fixed. This is done. You know, I think it's one of those, like, people would think like you and I, where you go, look, this is solvable. We know what people want. And I think once you get in there, you realize just how bad and broken it is, that it's not just... You sit there and go, we need so much to turn us around, and we don't have that, and this is done.
So you need – your entire workforce is broken. They are trained, incentivized, and you can't go and talk to each individual salesperson. You have to start at the top and hope that that message gets distilled down over time. And it's just too late. You really do need to start over. Man, it's crazy. End of an era. So the two questions is moving forward is, number one, is there a Radio Shack left, or is the name Radio Shack done by the end of 2015? Or do you think they'll keep? You know,
well, they're going to sell the name.
They go through chapter. They go through chapter 11. They reorg. They sell half of their stores. They close the other half. You know, do they keep anything around in a attempt to see if they can't become? You know. Remain what, you know, whatever they were, or do they just sell enough of their locations, or they sit there and go, now we'll just close the doors, it's not worth it, we'll sell it all off as assets.
So according to this article, it says to survive independently, Radio Shack would need to shrink substantially through bankruptcy. They could also discuss a co-branding with stores like Sprint, which again is kind of like, you know, they got eaten by the cell phone companies, so might as well just give up to them. And so they could co-brand with a Sprint store instead of retiring the Radio Shack brand altogether. But it's not clear how much value the Radio Shack name still holds. Its network of stores
is
more attractive for their physical footprint alone.
Yeah, I was going to say, man, if I were Sprint, I wouldn't want a co-brand. The only reason why you do that as Sprint is because they'd offer you a huge discount on – you wouldn't actually be buying those locations. Those would still be owned by Radio Shack, but it would just be – they'd be Sprint stores, you know, selling Sprint equipment. You'd do that because you couldn't afford to buy them outright, not because you want the Radio Shack brand.
Yeah, maybe.
You'd be stupid wanting as a Sprint. I mean, come on, it's Sprint. You've already got a miserable enough brand. Do you really want to tie yourself down with that anchor? Like,
I see what you're saying.
I say no, that as someone
I'll stick my foot in the sand. I do not think the store name will hang around.
Really? Okay.
Well, let me check. Is Blockbuster still around, or is that completely done?
I think Blockbuster is completely.
It's going to follow that same path.
Okay. Yeah, that's okay. I agree with that. I was going to say, I could see them. I think what they do is they hold on to a couple locations, their biggest locations where they were doing business, and they're not being offered crazy money by Amazon and Sprint. And they keep those locations around doing their thing, but there won't be anywhere near you, and they'll try to reinvigorate the brand. They'll probably not succeed. And eventually they will go the way of the dodo. Sorry, ham radio enthusiasts. It's just true. Accept it. So then I got a question. So what do you think about Amazon doing their retail location
thing? Yeah, I think they'll pick up a couple
thing.
Stores, but more for experimental needs rather than making a big push.
Yeah, the reason I keep coming back to it is because there was a big article this week about their first, like, retail location.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's basically was... it's a staff college campus store. And basically what happens is what college is it? Purdue. So they bought a place on Purdue University, and you go onto Amazon, you log into this like special Amazon at Purdue.com type thing. And when you purchase your stuff, you buy it through the school, and the pickup location is that store. So you'd like buy your books, you'd buy your toothpaste, you'd buy your soda, you'd buy your beer, whatever, probably not beer, but you'd buy your, you know, various stuff that they sell at college campus stores online from your dorm room. And then you just walk down to the store and you could pick it up. And so stuff that like is really, you know, is always available. I'm assuming you'll be able to pick it up right there, but for the most part, they actually have to deliver it, so you have to wait a day or two. But it's kind of a clever extension of what Amazon's all about, and it'll be interesting to see if that A, works at Purdue, and B, if that's You know, are they going to open up these Amazon stores as sort of like their, you know, a floor space for you to check out the Fire phones and their tablets? Or are they going to be doing this where they're also delivery locations? But no, it's cool. It's interesting to see what they're doing.
Yeah, I think they'll continue to experiment. And like you said, it'll be a showcase. It'll be delivery. It'll be all sorts of stuff.
Yeah.
Go read the newspaper. Go read the Washington Post there.
Yeah, the WAPO. That is so funny that they own a Washington Post.
Well, I guess it's Bezos, not Amazon, right?
Yeah, okay. Well, yeah,
it really only makes a difference in the tax and legal department, legal departments.
Right. I was going to say it's a... what's the phrase, the saying I'm thinking of? A difference without a...
I don't know.
Distinction without a difference.
Yeah, which, and if we're honest about it, it's Bezos. It's not Bezos who owns it, right? It's a corporation that he owns it.
Yeah. Which, you know, the way Bezos is, it's kind of all the same thing.
Yeah. It would be kind of cool if he wrote a personal check for it. That would be neat.
That would be neat. It'd be cool to be able to do that. So, speaking of all of our craft stuff with, like, as you mentioned, your various cheap do-it-yourself computers, the Raspberry Pi Corporation guys, Foundation, they had kind of big announcement this week. And at first I was like, oh, okay, this is cool. I listened to the article because I'm personally interested in it. And then as the week went on, I was like, I'm not going to bring it up. And then there was an article at the end of the week that I was like, nope, I'm bringing this up. This is cool. So what is the Raspberry Pi? It's a tiny system on a chip computer. That's different article than what I wanted. There we go. No, that's the wrong article too. Man, I hate it when I do that. I'm trying to find an article that actually listed all the specs, because it's pretty interesting when it's all there we go. Here we go. So when you actually all list it out. So basically what this is this is the next version of the Raspberry Pi computer. It has an impressive little beast. They went way out of their way with this one to update it in such a way that it had the same footprint. That was their big thing. Because the Raspberry Pi B Plus had some kind of minimal upgrades. People have been complaining, hey, why don't you upgrade this thing and make it more powerful? And they said, well, we could have easily done that, but it would have changed the layout. So we took our time and we designed something that had the same layout. So it's reverse compatible with other physical computers and stuff. Yeah, really smart. I completely agree. But they updated it with some pretty amazing stuff. So first off, they got a 900 megahertz quad core ARM Cortex A7 CPU. Cool. It's up from a single 700 megahertz single core chip. So it's a beast of an upgrade from a CPU perspective. I mean, it's just.
That's like 6 times the performance bump.
Yeah, in the title. Something like that. Thank you for the math. this thing is more powerful. And the first one wasn't any putts. I mean, it was, you know, these are in the ballparks of your, you know, mid to high range phones when it comes to profit processing performance. You know, it's not like it's got the A8 or the NVIDIA Tegra X1 beast, but it's a nice sized phone, you know, processing. It's got 1 gig of RAM, which is cool. It's pretty good. It's completely compatible with Raspberry Pi 1 software. The software will need to recompile to take advantage of the new multi-core processor, but hey, you know, it happens. Identical form factor. It's got the 1,000 gigabyte Ethernet port, which is, you know, great for, he's like, they're just these beastly little computers, and they're tiny. 40-pin extended GPIO, so you could do, this is where it becomes incredibly competitive with the Arduinos, is that 40-pin digital I.O. stuff. It's got a bunch of USB.
Okay, so time's out here. How's this different than an Arduino?
Okay, so an Arduino uses, the main chip on an Arduino is one of your various PIC-compatible chipsets. So there, it's basically the Raspberry Pi is really, you can think of it as like a full computer.
It's a very small computer, but
onboard memory, RAM. Yeah, and it's got all the different ports, so you could put it in a box, plug it into a TV, and do the whole thing. Whereas the Arduinos are incredibly robust but lightweight. They run a very simple programming core, and they tend to have more I/O and stuff, and you can get them for a little bit cheaper. They come in more form factors. They're totally open source. It's kind of just a, what are you going to use it for? Arduinos are they're easier for newer users, because they're so much simpler. Whereas with the Raspberry Pi, it's a full computer, so you got to like set up Linux, and you got to do this, you got to do that to get it all kind of up and running. This guy's got an HDMI port. It's got 4-pole stereo output with composite video port. It's got stuff for cameras. It's got stuff for touch display. It's got micro SD. All sorts of fun stuff. And it only costs 35 bones, which is incredible. That's where it really becomes incredibly compelling, is they're just super affordable.
So, like, what would you use one of these for?
Stuff.
One of the classic examples of people use these for are building arcade cabinets. You get a monitor, you get all your different, like, controller stuff that you make, and then you wire it to each of the GPIO pins, put some sort of an emulator on it, and now you can build an arcade cabinet that can run any emulated game from the last, you know, from 1980 to 99, sort of thing. Yeah, they're used for used for robotic type stuff. A lot of your do-it-yourself, like quadcopters, different highly automated things. They're big for that. People use them for all sorts of different controlled stuff, and they're just kind of fun because they're very powerful, and they're very powerful, and they've got a lot of different
flexibility, I guess, is,
and
I want to do some of that. I got to come up with a project, I guess.
Mhm.
I guess I still can make that washing machine notifier thing.
Boom. That's, you know.
But that would be an Arduino, to right? To do that.
That's the one that I sent you was an Arduino. Though this one, you could do it with this though. This would just be, you know, this would be like squirrel hunting with a bazooka. Thing's a beast. So one of the big differences between this one and the last one is, so Microsoft made kind of a big announcement as they're trying to make sure that they don't miss out on the Internet of Things. You can get a free copy of Windows 10 when it launches to run on this beast. Up to this point, they've all been Linux-based, command terminal type stuff. Pretty simple. So a fully supported GUI-based Windows 10, that's pretty impressive. Obviously, it's not going to be super high-performing, but you are talking about on the ballpark of a phone. So it's,
You said that it has a gig of memory. Is that,
Yes.
Doesn't have a hard drive, obviously.
No, it has. Generally, what people do is they use a micro SD slot, and I. So it's got. That's where you would put like your operating systems and just sort of your general use stuff. I don't think this actually has an eSATA for direct hard drive expansion, but you would, that's what the USB is okay. used for primarily. So if you need a bunch of gigabytes of space, you can just plug it in over the USB. So it's a cool little toy, and like you said, it's a, what you use it for, any automation your heart can desire. And just as a $35 computer, if you've got a screen and you've got a keyboard, you've got the rest of the stuff, and you just need a really lightweight computer for something, for a media center, that's another thing that a lot of people use them for, media centers. They're a great solution to that, just kind of a general purpose.
Yeah, I could see that.
Media center.
That's pretty slick.
And... yeah, so the thing that really sold me on it that I thought was awesome, turns out people are having a problem where if you take a picture of it, it restarts.
What?
Yeah, right. How does it know? It's a bit camera shy.
That's weird. That's one of those where you like.
It is.
I feel for the R&D guys, because you just, you know, that one comes back and they're like. What? Because you don't test for that.
Yeah. Yeah. Why would you? Well, and it's tough because if you're in the market of what they're doing, it totally makes sense. So basically, what happens is, camera flash will make the Raspberry Pi to freeze and reboot. You take a picture of it with a Xeon flash, so not an LED flash, but a Xeon flash, and it freezes and then reboots, and everybody's like. What? Well, it turns out this is a classic example of what is described as the photoelectric effect. What is the photoelectric effect? I'm glad you asked. It's basically how solar panels work. Photons come in, they hit metal, and it causes the electrons to shoot out. And depending on how you set up your conductive materials and your semiconductive materials, you can actually cause currents to be driven. Wow. And for those of you who don't know, the reason why from a broad perspective, there are incredible similarities between the process of making solar panels and making computer chips. And solar panels are a type of semiconductor. And so what's basically happening is the Xeon flash is hitting they believe that it is the power management chip on the board. As the photons are hitting that, for some reason, there's not enough design protections involved that when it hits that chip, it's energizing parts of the chip that it shouldn't be, and it's causing it to cycle through its power and telling it that something is having a power overload, and it's cycling as a result.
I think another solution is to stop taking pictures of it.
Well, that's actually the thing that everybody's that they're saying is don't take pictures. If you want to be able to take pictures of it, they're saying put it in some sort of a protective case. Like, because one of the big advantages of this thing is that you can do automated camera stuff.
Ah.
So. Nice. So people are saying, okay, well, you can't do that. So you got to put a case in it if you're going to be using it in that sort of environment. There are things that they can do from a R&D perspective to fix that. And
so I want the Raspberry Pi 2.1.
Exactly. And they probably will build that in future updates. But it just is a hilarious, oh man, that stinks. I actually read a really interesting anecdote about a company that was building new server chips and stuff. And they were working with a couple of their prototypes. And I'm sure you've seen those pictures online when they show you a picture of a chip outside of the package.
Yeah.
And they're all kind of colorful and stuff. They're so much prettier in real life. It's ridiculous. They, like, cameras just do not do justice to how pretty a completed silicon chip is, just sort of the different, like the depths of color and just the bandwidth and everything. And I've taken pictures of wafers and fabs before because they're just really pretty. Some of the colors that are produced are just, they're unreal. So there was this anecdote was they were in this lab with this new chip they had prototype chip that they had built, and they hadn't packaged it yet. So it's just the chip sitting there with all the different leads going to the different pins outside of no plastic, no encasing. And I guess one of the lab techs thought it looked really pretty and decided to take a picture of it. And it acted like all silicon acts when bombarded with photons. It acted as a solar cell and lit up the entire, all of these like super fine copper fibers that were going all the different pins. It just instantly incinerated, and they just fried this prototype chip. They were just like, how did you do that? Like,
spy.
It's right. Exactly. It is remarkable how sensitive, computer chips are to light. and like you said, it's weird because you just don't think about it normally, but yeah, it's something you have to consider.
Yeah, apparently. All right, I want to know, what's this Pono player thing? Pono player?
So the Pono player, the Pono player is Neil Diamond? Neil Young, that's what I thought.
Neil Young.
I was going to say, Neil Diamond's not right. So Neil Young has come up with what is called the Pono Digital Music Service. It was a device that he put on Kickstarter. It's a little bit expensive. It's like 400 to 300 bones to buy it. But it's kind of like a super-powered iPod is the best way to think of it. It's designed to hold your digital music, any different codec. But Neil Young was really bothered by the sound quality that was getting on his iPhone and his iPod. He thought it was just terrible, and he was just like, you could tell that it was this low quality codec. And so he decided to put together a technology team who would design a player that could reproduce effectively what is natural sound digitally. And so what does that mean? That just means basically sampling, compression and sampling. So we can do an MP3 player has a compressed low sample music rate, which means some of the music quality is lost during the compression and decompression. And then some of the music quality is lost because we can actually hear at higher frequencies than the sampling. Then it's as it's sampling, it's losing some of the data, some of the music. So effectively, the quality of the music's not there because the music is just not being recorded completely. And so what they were doing was they've come up with a system of recording at super high frequencies. So they're getting the entire waveform exactly the way that they're supposed to, and then they don't compress it. So there are these huge digital files. Originally, the MP3 was all about making small digital files, right? Because the internet was slow and hard drive space was super valuable. Also, in a world where we got the internet and tons of really small, you know, small storage components, they said, well, let's just do full quality audio. And that's basically what the Pono player is. It's a huge hard drive, and then it's got music output that is just super high quality. They just spent a lot of time and money making sure that this thing was great. And so combined with the Pono music service, this thing can just reproduce every sound. I mean, it's like listening to a record player, a traditional analog, where analog gets a lot of credit for being a better quality sound, because it's like really being there in the studio. And yeah, it is 400 bones. The Kickstarter video is basically Neil Young talking to a bunch of famous musicians, having them listen to the system, and them all going, wow, that is so amazing. It sounds so much better. It's just great. While the Pono is finally like shipping, people are getting it up. So they went and decided to do an actual blind test, and to see if people liked it more or not. I'm going to give you the spoiler alert. Yeah, people can't tell the difference. Even really talented musicians, like, that's what they do. They can't tell the difference. And now it's what's interesting about it is part of it is that there is definitely a difference in sound quality when you get a really expensive setup. Good headphones, good stereo, good amp, like everything's really high quality. That sounds better. No matter what is actually generating the initial preamp signal, like the actual music coming out. And so a lot of people are like, yeah, basically Neil Young just came up with like this really expensive music rig, and it does sound better than your cheap $8-$10 headphones. Like, it really legitimately does. But that has more to do with the fact that everything else in line in the stack of music playing is very high quality, not just the quality of the player. And which, you know, is not good if this is your new music, you know, thing. Except the only thing they got going for them is now there's this perception of it's the super high quality music player, and you know, people will like it for that reason. But yeah, they're just it's hilarious. Like, it's when you actually do the test, people can't hear it. And I remember I read an article, and I think I might have I can't remember if we talked about it on the show or not, but it actually got into the science of what people hear, how MP3 players work, and the different codecs that they were using and stuff. And the article basically came out and said this, like, from a scientific perspective, you can do better than the sample rate of an MP3. And actually, if you do an uncompressed MP3, the sound quality is different, and the hear can tell the difference. But when you start talking about, like, the sampling frequencies that they have for the Pono, like, you're so far above and beyond what the ear can hear. Just people can't tell. We're not that good. And it kind of goes back to the whole bottle of wine thing when they do blind tests of wine and people can't tell the difference between different wines. Well, you know, which is more expensive? Because that's just not how it works. Like, you know, a lot of our perception of value comes from how much we paid for it. They did a big test with violins. I think it was last year, and kind of rocked the whole classic violin thing, because they did this blind test of new violins, cheaper violins versus your more expensive violins. And they're talking about violins that range from the price of $2,000 to $1,000,000. The cheap ones are the $2,000 ones. But when you're talking about, like, 300-year-old violins that cost $500,000 compared to, you know, brand new ones that cost $2,000 as a manufacturer, as a builder, there's a big difference. Like, you really care that the $500,000 ones cost or, you know, sound better. And when they did the test, they're like, yeah, there's no difference. Like, it's you're buying an antique, which is cool.
Buy it for that reason.
But that's all you're buying. Yeah. And it doesn't actually sound better. And it's – or sound different, more importantly. And yeah. Yeah, which is frustrating. And the worst part about it is this, is like the open acknowledgement of the psychology, for the simple fact that you spent more money on it, so your enjoyment is actually higher. You enjoy it more, even though you can't actually tell the difference between what you spent. Even though, you know, it's just the simple fact that it's so much more expensive, that you're told it's so much higher quality, increases your level of satisfaction. So do you go out and buy it? Do you tell people it's not actually any better for you if they're enjoying it more? It's sort of it's the whole placebo thing. How frustrating is that? I kept oscillating back and forth, even though I read that. I actually believed that scientific paper that was saying it doesn't actually sound different. You can't. I was sort of like, yeah, you know, why not? $400. You get a nice player. You put it in as like part of your whole ecosystem of music devices, and it's just sort of it completes the whole, rounds out the whole thing. And then reading this, I was like, this is stupid. That's $400 I can spend on music. not just the music player.
Yeah, that's true. Well, it even sounds like, I mean, yeah. The design, the physical design is not great either.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a prism. It's kind of odd. Doesn't fit in the pocket. It's catchy. Looks cool.
Hmm. Well, all right. So that's the Pono player. Nice yeah. try, Neil Young, Diamond, whatever your name
is. Say, that one's not done yet, though, because Sony has got their competitor coming out. That's like a $1,200 music player.
Oh, my gosh.
And so for your super high-end music players, there's going to be some... there's going to be some legs to it, I think. I think in 5 years we'll still be talking about the Pono player.
All right, fair enough.
You know, or the Pono music service in general. So you want to go or do I want to go?
So in a world where you can order almost anything online, finding wall art for the home can be difficult. There's a lot of ways to go. You know, you can print off stuff from like traditional retailers. You can go to art.com. You can print off your Instagram photos. But there really isn't a marketplace, a good one, for like artists and buyers to come together and, you know, in a single marketplace and sell your stuff. And Curios, C-U-R-I-O-O-S, is aiming to change that. Now, here's what's cool about it. Number one, they've got like 3,000 pieces of artwork and 500 curated artists, which is kind of cool. But that's not the coolest part. This week, they launched an augmented reality app where what you do is you print off a barcode. I guess you download the app, print off a barcode, whatever. You tape that barcode to your wall, and then you can use that app to go through all the different art to see what would actually look best in your home.
That's awesome.
That is, right?
That's cool. Okay, I'm doing it. I may not buy anything, but I'm definitely downloading the app.
Yeah, pretty neat. Let's see here. The different... categories, I guess, that they have. They have typography. Nude is apparently up at the top. They have So Surreal, Movies and Heroes. They've got some urban art, abstract, and then a bunch of feature artists as well. Actually looks pretty cool.
Yeah, this is very cool. Art lover and curators. With my full... Matthew Dean for this is one of those things, man. It's they've got different fonts for literally everything. So just like your full name is a different font than the font that you actually, when you type in your name, it comes up with a different. Jeez Louise, these guys are out of control. Get fresh editors. Okay, I'm going to do this later because it's yelling at me now. That's really cool. That's a cool idea. I really like that. You know, being able to see it on your wall. It's just a cool. It's a cool, clever. Well, yeah. I mean, it, from a marketing perspective, it's cool and clever and works. But it's actually a useful tool, I think. And you know, as we move into this realm of, you're going to see more and more of that sort of thing. You know, because that basically is what the Microsoft's Wicked Cool headgear thing. I can't remember what they called it. What do they call it?
HoloLens?
Yeah, the HoloLens. That's what the HoloLens does. That's one of its main selling features, is the ability to put that stuff on the wall. I'm a big fan of... There was a project that was on Kickstarter that I decided that I didn't have enough money to justify, where they took a monitor, a big old monitor, and they connected it to an online service that would just cycle through different pieces of digital art. And so you'd have this huge... I mean, like, it was a big screen that would just cycle through digital art, and it was really cool, and I really liked it. And, you know, this is something that I think about, and I like this... this is a nice iterative step, right? Where they're leveraging a pretty simple technology, the whole being able to read a barcode so you can, you know, we've seen Hewlett Packard do things like that. This is, it's a well-trod technology, I guess is what I'm trying to get at. And being able to do this sort of augmented reality, and then they just hook it up to their database of JPEGs. That's awesome. Nice job. And I wonder, it would be cool to be able to actually make it as like a, you know, as like a third party app that sort of, you know, even, so you could go through your own article of, you know, you could connect it to any database of pictures, whether it's your on your phone or whatever. So you can kind of go through, you know, that would be a cool third party app, but it's just a selling experience. It's neat. It's a really good idea. I like it.
Yeah, I thought it was a very cool
nice job.
Idea. You can spend way too much time just browsing the art collections. That Movies and Heroes one is pretty fun. I like it, man.
Yeah.
There you go. Check it out. It's cool.
Aww. What? What? So it's saying that my email is already in use. Let's see here. Forgot my password. It's now I'm curious. Sorry, you distracted me, James.
That's what happens.
Did I already sign up for this service? That seems impossible.
Maybe it had a different name at some time.
Yeah, it did. Oh yeah. Okay, you're right. That's probably exactly what happened. But so speaking of typography and art, this is kind of cool, I think. So the company that owns Times New Roman and a couple of other fonts now owns emojis.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So it's just sort of a – this is – I don't know. This is one of those weird curiosities of kind of how technology moves over time. And typography is a weird, the history of typography in tech is unexpectedly intertwined. And you know, legendarily that has a lot to do with Steve Jobs and him taking that typography class or that calligraphy class and him learning about all the different aspects of typography and him insisting that it be present in on the original Macintosh as a way to really set it apart from your kind of terminal-based stuff, you know, terminal-based computers that everything was done ugly. You know, he said, we've got the ability to build a GUI. Let's make it look beautiful with the typography. And they introduced fonts and stuff. But a lot of these companies, font companies, have been around forever. I mean, pretty much since Gutenberg, right? Like these guys, it's a big deal what they do. And so Monotype is one of your oldest companies. And Monotype, for the uninitiated, is a company that helped revolutionize typesetting at the latter end of the 19th century and owns typefaces you probably see every day, like Helvetica, Times New Roman, Franklin Gothic. And they bought Swift, which spelt with a Y, which is the company that makes one of the big companies that are pushing emojis and owning emojis. And basically they spent $27 million on it. But it's just an acknowledgement of the fact that like your companies that basically came into existence as a, you know, a way of managing how typewriters and printing presses worked are moving into the digital future. And they're refusing to be left behind. It's cool. It's cool when you see that happen, I think. And I imagine a company like Monotype that survived the digital revolution, really, you know, they're very aware of not getting left behind on that bandwagon because I'm sure they saw competitors in the 80s just get, you know, Well, they watched them trounce competitors by acknowledging the fact that things were moving forward and fonts were going to continue to be important, and they had to get on to the next one. But wow, it's kind of a cool corporate opera-y type thing. Huh?
Yeah, one of those like just way behind the scenes things.
Yeah. It's these are the things that I pay attention to, James. I normally don't bring them
to
you, but I actually think they're really interesting. And kind of another behind the scenes type thing. We both use Adblock Plus, right? Which means the internet looks markedly different to us than it does to the rest of the world. This has been, it's just kind of surfaced this week, but Amazon, Google, and Microsoft are soft whitelisted. They are able to get ads through that. It's like the fact that when you Google something, all your Google ads are still there in the sidebar and stuff. Well, how does that happen? Why is it that Adblock Plus is able to, why can they catch everything but don't catch that? It's not because Google's smarter than them. It's because Google pays them.
Interesting.
So Adblock has a couple of rules on what they allow to be whitelisted, and it has to do with, minimalist. They're non-intrusive. They're not obnoxious. They have different, they whitelist smaller websites for free that meet that criteria. But for the big boys, if you you want to play ball with Adblock and with people with Adblock Plus, you gotta put your money where your mouth is. Gotta get a little dirty.
So what's the new one? What are we all switching to overnight?
Right. Well, I don't think anybody. I think Adblock Plus has actually done a pretty good job of managing how far they can push that, where they're letting just enough through that they can stay fiscally solvent, but not so much through that they're not obnoxious. And Google is playing ball. Amazon's playing ball. Their response is, okay, there's certain criteria we have to meet. We'll meet them. And what it ends up being is that it's not all ads are getting blocked. It's just they're not uglying up the internet with their ads. I'm just really glad that Engadget has decided to, and TechCrunch have decided to not pay to allow their ads to get through, because those sites are awful. Actually, Mac Daily News is worse, though. They are by far the worst with ads. Every once in a while, I like stumble onto Mac Daily News on somebody else's computer. I'm just like, what is this? This is not the same website. Because it actually looks pretty slick with Adblock Plus on, I think. But looks terrible otherwise.
How about this little comment from Tweenie? There are an awful lot of people on here who think they shouldn't have to look at ads. Blocking ads is usually denying a website its sole source of income, and people don't want to do it because they just don't like to look at it, and they block them just because they can. Then some people are trying to accuse Adblock of being unethical.
That's so stupid. I mean, I get what Adblock is doing, and it's one of those things where it's, as far as I'm concerned, they're giving me a really good service. It costs money to do what they do. They have to build these services out. They have to, they're in a continual arm race with the advertisers. So there's, it's not something that you build once and done. And let's face it, I didn't donate to their foundation. Did you?
No.
Yeah, nobody does. So they got to get revenue somehow, and it's not going to be through selling ads. Kind of. I mean, actually, it ends up that's exactly what they do. They just sell them for Google.
I was trying to see logged on to Twitter, and I don't see a promoted tweet on here. Because I see it on my phone.
Yeah. Yeah, that's... that. Honestly, that to me, the best part about AdBlock Plus is fixing it on... fixing YouTube. No ads on YouTube. I hate ads on my phone. It drives me nuts. Mm-hmm. Actually, the one that really kills me is when you, like, I'm going to go watch a movie trailer, and they have an ad for another... they have another movie trailer before I watch a movie trailer. I don't know why that bothers me so much. At least, like, sell me, like, a Swiffer vacuum or something. Don't, like, you know... come on. Like, I'm about to watch a commercial. You're going to show me another commercial? Come on.
This is ridiculous. I'm about to watch a commercial. That's funny. Well, they just know you like those types of commercials, so why not? Just keep showing them to you. Makes sense.
Yeah, so it's cool, though. So this is kind of interesting. I almost missed this. Forgot this article. So do you don't drink coffee, do you?
Nope, I do not.
Okay. Why don't you grow up? join the caffeine addicted populace. I do drink coffee. I drink coffee instead of drinking energy drinks nowadays because energy drinks are bad for you. And coffee has antioxidants.
I think it tastes bad, personally.
It's a learned taste, James, which I've always... yeah, I know. That's one of those, like, moral... it's not a moral, but it's one of those weird thought experiments. If once you get used to the taste, you really enjoy it. But you have to get used to the taste. Is it worth, you know... that is a thought experiment that I have actively it's an actual experiment I've actively engaged in quite a few times, and I've tried to like logic out the if you have to get used to it in order to like it, but you end up really liking it, is it worth it or is it just stupid? Like I don't know. It's hard to figure out. Okay. But the long and short of it is I have gotten used to it. Keurig is one of your leading companies. They're a subsidiary of Green Mountain Coffee, I think is the name of the company. But the basic premise of it is you get these little plastic cups. Have you ever used them before for hot chocolate? Other childish things. You put the cup in there, you press a button, and it brews one cup of coffee for you. One cup, per K cup is what they call them. It's a pretty cool little system, works very well, very robust. Everybody's had them for a long time. Well, Keurig decided they wanted to get really fancy, and they've come out with a new type of device they call the Keurig 2.0. It's got some fancy new features. One of the big ones is it allows you to do multiple or two different size cups. So the K cup is a single serving. Well, now they do these like I can't remember what they call. They're called. Doesn't matter. These bigger cups that allow you to brew an entire craft, so you can brew like one thing for your company, right? And everybody can have multiple cups out of it, which is just not healthy. Don't drink that much coffee, people. But it's it allows you to actually they really expand what they can do. With the size of the cup, the temperature, different stuff like that, so that you can get more fancy on how you actually make your coffee, that it really has opened them up. But they they made one little change that was a requirement, really. If you're going to use one of these, you're going to have different types of cups and different brewing recipes and stuff like that. Machine, it needs to know what kind of a cup you're using. So they put this little scannable thing that's printed on every single one of their cups that tells the machine this is the type of coffee it is. And then it will act accordingly. It'll make the right size coffee based on the K-cup that is put into it. And which is cool, pretty advanced. There's one problem, James, and that's if it doesn't have the proper coating on it, it will not make you a cup of coffee. And that seems fine, except this is the deal. So Green Mountain Coffee went from a making, you know, pretty good money, but they're kind of a regional coffee company, to a $4 billion a year multinational company when the Keurig maker came along. I mean, this is a big company all of a sudden. And one of the ways that they make money, obviously selling the hardware, but they also sell licensings for making K-cups. So like Starbucks, in order to sell a K-cup, they actually pay Green Mountain Coffee for the rights to be able to make Starbucks K-cups. And everybody is supposed to do that. But a K-cup, if you've ever held one, are cheap little plastic. I mean, like, they're super easy to make. And so a lot of companies, pretty much anybody who's too small to get sued, have made third-party K-cups that aren't compatible with this new system. They are physically compatible. You put them in, they should work because it's the same style. They just don't have that little printed text on them that allows them to work. And it turns out this has upset the user base.
I feel like a sticker could solve your problem.
Yes, they're actually, you can buy little things that will fake it for you, but it's kind of galling. The problem is it's what they're, so their profits, their sales fell 12% last quarter, which is a big deal in the first full quarter that the 2.0 was on sale. And their Amazon reviews are coffee deprived fury. They're basically saying this is really dumb. This is awful. Like, you shouldn't be doing this. Like, let us use the device the way we want to. It's being compared to DRM for music, where you can't use, you know, you can't use, you buy your song and you can't use it where you want to use it. And they're stopping you. And the thing is, yes, if you Google Keurig 2.0, it auto completes for hack.
So I feel compelled to remind people that I do not represent HP or any of HP's opinions. Because this business model seems very similar to another one I've seen, where you buy the new main device and all the previous, we'll just call them cartridges, pods, whatever. Don't work, and you have to buy the new pod to work with this new device. And you have third parties who want to, you know, you to use their material instead.
Yes.
If I'm thinking of my example correctly, I think Keurig will be fine in the long run.
Yeah, my opinion on this, and I think they'll survive, and they know they will. I just think that they messed up on how they did this, and it's funny. It'd be so easy to mitigate this problem. Basically, what they ran into is the fact that nobody has these cups. One of the biggest problems is people buy their cups in bulk. And so you get the new K-cup, the Keurig, and it doesn't work with your existing set of coffee, of K-cups. And so people are upset, and it's hurting their sales.
You just got to go out and buy new K-cups. That's pretty easy.
Upgrade. Yes, but people don't want to do that.
Too bad.
And they say what they're going to open themselves up for is another competitor to come in and...
They could get Well, they're not big enough to get an antitrust lawsuit against them, but
yeah, I think it's what's frustrating about it is it seems like it's such an easy thing to do. Is you basically come up and say you sell two new Keurig 2.0s, and you make a big deal. You change the K-cup. That's what you do, is you change the single serving thing. You make it physically different so that the traditional K-cup can't fit inside.
They
don't
want
to
change their manufacturing.
And
they want
the
best of both worlds.
I know. And that's the problem, is it's like what you do is you do the first year, you make, you know, and I don't know. I feel like the first year what you could do is you just basically sell is you do the transition slowly. You have to manage the transition where it's like the first generation of the 2.0 will work with the bigger cups and every K-cup. And then the Keurig 3.0 in a year and a half, that's when they – now everything's already forward compatible. All the older cups are forward compatible. Everybody's new stock has the new sticker on, and that's when you pull the trigger on the smaller K-cups now require the sticker too, and nobody would have noticed. And this is what Apple is brilliant at. They have a big enough, long enough roadmap that they are able to institute technologies that are forward compatible. So when they pull the trigger on some new thing – it's retroactive with your old set of, you know, music or your phone or whatever. And I feel like Keurig just, you know, they're a relatively new company in this space, and they just really fumbled this one bad. They're like, this is such an easy one to avoid. You just take 2 years to do it, to make that transition, to make it more difficult for people to hack their stuff. And then the worst part about it is that it's just this, it's an image scanner. So like you said, the first hack that everybody's going to come up with is you buy this little thing and you just put it, you permanently install it, and now it works. Like, or, you know, people are going to figure out how to hack it or whatever. I don't know. I really feel like
they have entered into a whole new ball game. Welcome. It's a cat and mouse game is what it is. And I can tell you from personal experience that, you know, it's all about, like you said, change the size of the cups, change the authenticator, change the mix, you know.
They'll figure it out. The company will be fine. Keurig will be around for a long time.
They'll just tick a lot of people off.
Yeah.
Trust me.
And which is fine. I mean, like, I don't actually have a problem with the company doing that. It's annoying when it's like, how did you guys not see this coming? Or how did you not manage it better? Because it's very easy to manage.
Well,
and maybe. You just have to, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe. Okay, let's be honest, James. HP, they can be a little bit ham-handed too. They, you know, part of their problem is that they're not as – there are companies that manage this sort of thing very gracefully, and there are companies
The example that you gave, you know, with Apple, there's a fundamental difference there, okay? Yeah, it's – I got to be careful. again, I do not represent HP, okay? Or any of HP's opinions.
Okay.
I'll even put an asterisk around all of this and say I'm probably wrong, because I feel like that's what I need to say here. when Apple makes a change, it is genuinely to improve the customer experience. It is not necessarily to lock out third-party suppliers that are eating into their margins. Okay?
Right.
I have no proof. I'm not officially saying this because I don't represent HP, but this is not always the case for all companies. And I think Keurig is an example here where the reason why they did it was to cut out third-party competitors, you know, third-party cup manufacturers. It wasn't to actually improve the customer experience. Now, don't get me wrong. That's going to be part of their argument that's why we did this. It was to increase, you know, consistent quality and other stuff and you know, improve the customer experience. I mean, that's what they're going to say, but we all know the real reason why they're doing it. And they've got just enough evidence and data where you can't convict them. You know, obviously they got sued, but they're going to win or it's going to get dropped or whatever. Again, trust me. I know these things.
I guess what my point is it's like, I get them doing it and I don't even blame them for doing it. It's just when you make a transition like that, there are ways to.
Yeah, there are ways to mitigate it, I suppose. But no matter what, you're going to tick people off.
Yeah. Well, yeah, people will be upset, but I guess I don't think you have to see the 12% drop in sales. If, you know, the problem is that it's the actual supply of coffee or of your raw material is incompatible with the future stuff and with the new device, which is frustrating to a lot of people, and especially
in some cases that's purposeful.
I know, and I think I think what's frustrating for people is that they don't understand. It's transparent, but what they're doing. But you could have done it in such a way where a much smaller audience wouldn't have been affected. Because the problem is if you got Starbucks cups or even Green Mountain cups that like actually made by the same company that makes the Keurig, those are not compatible with your new coffee maker, and that would upset me. I would not be happy about that. And they didn't go out of their way to allow the transition of supply that would have mitigated. I will notice now. That's not fair to me.
Well, see, and I will admit, where they made a mistake was they didn't get the cups onto the shelves fast enough. That was definitely a mistake on their part. Because what you want to do – this is so weird. What you want to do is have the supplies – right there with the machine all at the same time. And so that when it comes out, two things happen. You're the only source. And so customers get trained to go only to you, and your competitors, cause that's what they are, have had zero time to figure out how it works. And, so they got to spend time figuring out how to get around your DRM essentially, which they'll do. And eventually they'll crack it, because that's what happens. Trust me, I know. And but you get it could be a month, it could be 6 months, it could be a year head start, where you're the only game in town, and therefore everyone gets trained to go just to you.
Yeah, maybe that is the heart of their problem, is that they were looking at the 6 month sales boost of stuff before competitors.
Because
if you
there are some companies that will literally fly the supplies anywhere and everywhere for any cost to get it on the shelf to be there, because they know the value of it being there when the customer comes in to buy it and them being the only source. I think Keurig missed that particular part of the equation. I mean, we're talking we'll spend millions and millions of dollars to get a cartridge there, a pod, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. It's an interesting.
What if they lose money on the machine and make it back on the coffee cups or not? Which would partially explain.
I doubt
the
they
loss in. Did they say that was loss in revenue or profit?
Sales.
Never mind.
Yeah. But it's one of those things where, I don't know. I just think it could have been done better. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they knew this was just a calculated part of it, and they knew they would lose this, but they've got a longer term plan, and they were willing to accept that. But I doubt it. I think they were surprised, and that people got upset.
Well,
what? Have you guys not been paying attention?
Yeah. I could have told you that.
Yeah. But. Oh.
Keurig.
Okay. I think I got one more article on me. So, Staples bought Office Depot. Yeah, I don't know. That just seemed appropriate in a series of articles about, consumer locations and stuff getting bought, but Office Depot is no more. They're now a subsidiary of the Staples brand.
Yeah, I've known it for a while. They're both huge partners for HP supplies, and and so it has a big influence on HP. Not big. I should hedge a little bit. It has an influence. A few million dollars, but, on a billion-dollar base. So it's not huge, but it's big to you and me. There's one of those unforeseen things. I don't know. Okay, I'm going to talk about it anyways. I feel like I'm going to get myself in trouble.
It's
fine.
It's
going to
be a fun show.
Again, numbers are small. Numbers are small. Let me put it that way. But what you have happen is there are all these ripple effects where when you buy a store, they start talking about consolidating stores because you can. Because, for example, in one of the towns in Corvallis, there's a Staples and an Office Depot. They're like less than a mile away from each other. You don't need both. You just need one.
Right.
As a result of that, you'll need about half the amount of inventory in that town. Yeah.
Yes.
See, that's where it starts to affect their suppliers. Because all of a sudden they go, now we're good. We're not going to buy any this quarter because we have enough. So there's a transition there. Because in theory, they're going to sell through is the same. They just don't. It's literally the inventory levels drop. And so
right.
All of companies will be affected by that. HP's one of them, but so are all the paper ones.
So is it one of those things where you knew because you had been told and you were adjusting your predictions ahead of, accordingly, or did you okay, it wasn't like one of those things where you guys saw them change what they were ordering and you were like, well, obviously something's happening.
Our head guys talked with their head guys and they kind of knew what was happening, and so started hedging.
Cool. Interesting.
That's kind of what happened. So it's already built in. Don't worry about it, the street. We're good. No change.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right. Sounds good.
But anyways, again, one of those, like, you don't really think about it type things, but it has a ripple effect to all those other tech companies. You know, it's not nearly as backwaters as the Monotype and Swift, but...
Yeah.
But it is kind of like, oh yeah, that is all interconnected and stuff. If you think about it, whoever, Radio Shack was, whoever's stuff Radio Shack was stocking, all of a sudden that dried up pretty quick. I mean, it sounds like they weren't doing a lot of inventory turns anyways, but
yeah.
Had a bunch of buybacks, that's for sure. Which is always kind of a bummer. But
yeah.
That's how that works. Pretty interesting. Yeah, dude, Staples, man.
They're killing it. Well, I don't know if they're killing it, but they're not dying, which is nice.
They have a nice print center. I go to it pretty regularly. I have someone living in my apartment building who works at Staples. So, right, keep going strong. It's kind of fun.
Sprinkling in my apartment building. I think that was the first official mention.
I've talked about it before.
I noticed. Well, I think you've called it my apartment building. People are living there. It was first, like...
Yeah, I guess. I was going to say, it's always fun, like, learning where people work. All of a sudden, I'm like, oh, I'll become a patron of that. Like, we brought on a chef from a local burger joint. I'm like, hey, guess where I'm having lunch most of the time now? Sweet. Kind of fun.
Nice.
Kind of fun. Yeah, dude. Staples. That's big. What are they going to call it, like, Staple Depot? Nah.
Yeah, it's pretty... It's a pretty good name, I mean.
All right, cool, man. Cool. Let's see here. Got to switch that audio back. All right. Hi, everybody. Thank you for joining us. We do genuinely appreciate it. And, you're listening to episode 176, in case you missed that. So don't forget to check out the show notes at furloughbros.com. Again, that'll be on episode 176, followed by a colon and a highly creative title somewhere in there. Or you just search for that number. Chances are it'll pop up. And if you're listening to this in the month of February, it'll be up near the top. otherwise... We thank you for listening. It's been a joy talking tech and having you guys listen along. My name is James Furlough. What are you? No.
I'm the Grammy-performing brother.
My singing brother. I said something like that. Anyways, he is Matthew Furlough. And so we will talk next time.
Thank you.